The Bob Siegel Show is brought to you in part by Web Studio, Primetime Advertising Corporation, and the Law Office of Thomas Pinkerton. The views and opinions are solely those of the host and guests and do not necessarily represent KCBQ or its sponsors. It's time now for the Bob Siegel Show, a religious open forum where all questions are welcome. And now, here's your host, Christian apologist, Bob Siegel.
And this is Bob Siegel. So, you'd like to believe in God, but if God is such a loving God, why doesn't he rescue us from this horrible economy we're living in? Well, God does miracles when miracles are needed. For most everyday situations, God gave us another coping mechanism, a seldom little invention, seldomly used, called brains. Our economy does not have to be the way it is. The problem is not with the money, but with the people. When this radio show first premiered 5 years ago, I never thought the day would come when I would devote an entire program to economics. I know economics is important and always has been, but it's always been one of those subjects I would zone out under whenever I heard it discussed. The topic was right up there on my list next to the topography of Finland or the latest catalog of Tupperware lids. But now, in this last year, the economy burns in the forefront of my mind. I guess panic will do that to a person, and many are panicking because they believe our president has no intention of saving our economy because he doesn't want to save capitalism and instead wants to use the economic crisis as an excuse to lead us towards socialism. These words have been tossed back and forth a lot lately, socialism, capitalism. Many conservative peers are saying we should not accuse Obama and the Democrats of being socialists. Evidently, the word is too accusatory. Socialism, of course, gets defined in different ways because there are many kinds of socialism. There are varying degrees. We're talking about a spectrum. But if we wanted to define the term broadly in terms of government, part of that definition would include government-mandated redistribution of wealth. Not only is Obama moving this direction, he promised during his campaign he would move this direction, and some of us were actually paying attention. Still, we are being cautioned by those in our own camp to not use the S word. If we do, Democrats will call us mean-spirited. Personally, I think Democrats would call conservatives mean-spirited if they sneezed or said God bless you when somebody else sneezed. So we may as well quit mincing words and speak up. Well, it's still legal to speak up. Putting aside the fact that the term socialist is simply the most honest description of the direction our country is headed under Obama, Pelosi, and Reid, let's pause for a moment of reflection and remember how liberals have been treating the subject. Liberals, when simply discussing socialism in its own right, apart from Obama, oh, there's nothing wrong with socialism. Many countries in Europe are socialists, and they're quite progressive. The real evil here is capitalism with its greed and unfairness to the poor. Now, these same liberals, when conservatives call Obama a socialist, oh, that kind of hateful demagoguery is inappropriate. And then Obama, sometime in the near future, when he has accomplished all his plans. Now, I want everyone to understand that our new policies are not socialist. Let me be very clear on this point. And then the Obama supporters reacting to his speech. Well, I guess we aren't living under socialism after all. How do we know this? Because Obama doesn't call it socialism. He calls it something else. Well, today our show is honored by an expert on the subject of economics who can do away with the myth and replace it with some fact. John Sandy teaches economics at the prestigious University of San Diego. He's also a good friend from years gone by. John, welcome to our program.
Thank you very much.
Now, how long have you been over at USD teaching now?
Starting my 24th year.
24 years. So now, is that, do you have tenure by this time?
Oh, yeah.
20 years?
Tenure, a long time ago.
Okay, so your grandfather clause in. They're going to keep you no matter what.
Let's hope so.
Do you have a... I know that USD is a private Catholic college technically. I also know that sometimes private colleges swing the direction of the public universities. Where are they at with academic freedom? Are you pretty free to just teach whatever you like in your class?
Yeah, I've had no constraint. USD takes undergraduate education very seriously. They're very committed to a quality experience, and they sort of entrust the teaching aspect to the professors. So,
now, is this true in the other fields too? It's not as saturated with political correctness as
I would. Well, and it may be, but it would be sort of because people individually embrace that. I don't think it's institutionally imposed.
Well, what's the climate like in your class and other classes with the economy? Especially, it must be interesting to be in a college economics classes with the economy these days.
My classes are always horribly unorganized and a little bit anarchical. Right. But the climate is good, and the students do well. We have very good students. I appreciate them being in my class. They have a choice. It's like when they tell you, we're glad you chose our airline. I feel like that about the students in my classes. They have a choice over other professors and other sections, and I'm happy to have them along.
Is economics required in the GE?
Economics serves both as a GE and a prerequisite for degrees in the business school. And the economics group, if you will, is housed inside of the School of Business. So we sort of serve a servant's role to the larger School of Business.
So you have the econ majors and the people that are taking it as required. And are,
right.
And undergrads and graduates too, or just undergrads?
I'm principally with undergraduates. At the MBA level, there are some economics courses. They tend to be statistics or managerial economics or forecasting, maybe a monetary policy type class here and there. And the students are allowed to take economics classes. Students in the business majors are allowed to take economics classes as electives. So yeah, we see the whole university at the lower level, and then mostly either econ or business econ or business students through the higher years.
Well, we've had quite a year in terms of the economy. I know things were going on probably several years ago, and people like you were noticing it and warning people. Why don't you take us back and, in your own words, give us your take on the history of how we got to where we are right now.
Before we start, you should always note that the U.S. economy cycles, and it's not a novel. And it's typical to have anywhere from a 4 to a 6 year expansion followed by an 18 month to 24 month contraction. And these things seemingly are unavoidable. This one's getting a great deal more attention because it's been compared to the Great Depression. So far, it's a little bit closer to what we had in the late 70s and the early 80s.
Under Carter?
Beginning with Carter and then coming around under Reagan. Usually there are clear signs as to whether a recession begins as a money or a monetary phenomenon, or as a spending phenomenon. And there are camps with regards to explaining business cycles that will put primacy on either money, so-called monetarism, or more specifically the quantity theory of money, or spending, which is primarily Keynesian economics. This particular one was not a monetary recession. It was a rather curious amount of very extensive lending to people who weren't qualified. And that would have contained itself. I mean, that literally would have taken care of itself. There was a frenzy to lend into housing. There was a social goal of sort of establishing stability and progress in society through home ownership, which is a desirable goal. But the lending went on to people who weren't qualified to repay, and you can sort of see where that's going to go. It wouldn't take a genius to figure out that wasn't going to work. It would have pretty well ended there and just been a slap on the wrist to mortgage lenders had the mortgages not been bundled into something called mortgage-backed securities, and then they became speculative instruments that also caught fire, and the value of those speculative instruments got astronomical. All of it backed on the assumption that housing would continue to go up in value forever. It was the increasing housing prices that covers the loan. Real estate loans are secured by the asset themselves, and so if the price of the house goes up and you foreclose the house, the lender can recapture the loan on the sale. So there was a lot of risky lending going on, and what was supposed to make it safe was ever-increasing price of houses. So if you're looking for a point to when would we have thought this approach would have caused some trouble, it was about the time that housing peaked, because all of a sudden you're going to get people in a position where they can't repay loans, and the houses aren't going to be big enough to cover the mortgage, and now the lenders are going to be on the line, and now all these funny extended derivatives, these mortgage-backed securities, are going to become questionable. And you had something unusual happen this time, which is once the housing market peaked, and then the foreclosures began, which is what would have happened anyway, it spread rapidly to the value of those speculative instruments. And so it moved away from just, say, a loanable funds market, just borrowing money market, to larger speculative and financial capital and equity markets, stock markets and such, because of this tie-in that they had actually rebundled and repackaged mortgages as investment instruments. So anyway, I think everybody's probably familiar with that on one level or another. What it came down to was, and it was rather a perfect storm, you had the housing market peak, you had the foreclosures begin, you had the obvious too much exposure to risk by mortgage lenders, and then you had speculators and equities and all other markets, financial type markets, getting tied up with bad mortgages, and the bottom fell out.
And this happened right before the election.
Yeah, which is, yeah, if you were... If
you didn't talk about a perfect storm.
Yeah, if you were running
a perfect storm for Obama, really.
If you were a politician running this last few years of the economy, really hasn't been very good. That was a script that you couldn't have written any better for yourself.
Absolutely. Now, I hear a lot of blame. The Democrats blame the Republicans. I'm of the opinion there's blame on both sides. I certainly tend to blame the Democrats more. But in the interest of fairness, how much did George Bush contribute to our bad economy?
Well, I don't want to make it percentages. The idea of lending to people to get them into housing so that you can sort of stabilize the social aspects of society goes back to Lyndon Johnson, and it's been aggressively pursued by pretty much all the presidents. It just got out of hand under Bush. It was way too much of it going on, and there's some debate as to whether, you know, Bush had his ownership society, and moving people into home ownership was a very important part of that. And he would brag about how high the percentage of home ownership had become. Bill Clinton has his hands dirty in this, too. He had actually used the Justice Department and Janet Reno to actually threaten banks' licenses if they wouldn't make enough subprime loans. So it's a disease that's been going for a long time.
And wasn't the organization of Acorn involved in
they somehow tie in
blackmailing banks as well?
I think they tie in, too. There's all sorts of behavioral issues that have occurred with regards to lending over the decades, some of it dubious. Discriminatory lending is sometimes called redlining, when certain areas are sort of redlined out on a map, as it were, and banks would naturally not loan into those areas, and that sort of goes against this idea that, you know, let me back up. Things that will stabilize society historically are marriage and home ownership. They have a tendency to come together. In pursuit of stabilizing society through home ownership, you really do have to get around things like redlining or, you know, banks being unwilling to take a chance on people. That said, there are really, really conservative lending rules that banks traditionally follow and savings and loans traditionally follow. Had they been followed, none of this would have happened.
What are some of these rules?
Well, if you've ever borrowed yourself, you know them, but
like
basically...
a background check, how much
money even beyond all
you're
that,
making.
They basically take your monthly income and they say you should not allocate more than 33% of your take-home pay towards a mortgage. And so they back you into the value of the house from one-third of your take-home pay. And for most people in like Southern California, where housing prices tend to be quite high, you wouldn't be able to get even a median house for one-third of your take-home pay. Things that can raise that are, you know, lower interest rates or more favorable terms. And what fed into a lot of this problem was, in addition to some pressure either from various administrations or the banks themselves to continue lending on housing, were some new instruments that came and allowed people to borrow 100% or allowed, like you said, people to borrow without having background checks or without proving their income. And all that does is just make it more risky. Banking is a really conservative business and a very easy business to understand. They essentially borrow money at a certain rate, lend it at a slightly higher rate, and they live on the margin. And as long as that's going on, it's all good.
Until somebody starts to tamper with it.
What they can't have is this slowdown. One of the really fascinating parts about this recession is why the banks haven't re-engaged in lending.
Okay, let's talk about that when we return. My guest, John Sandy, economics professor at University of San Diego. We'll be right back. Your own website without a lot of cost and trouble? Hi, I'm Bob Siegel, here to tell you about Web Studio. Web Studio allows people to create their own websites simply and easily without knowing HTML. With Web Studio, you avoid the learning curve of front page and the expense of a web designer. Web Studio has 14 different galleries that contain graphics, sounds, and everything else you need. For more information about Web Studio, go to webstudio.com.
Call Bob now at 888-344-1170. That's toll free, 888-344-1170. Bob may have strong opinions, but he also likes to hear what you have to say.
Welcome back to our program. You're listening to the Bob Segal Show. My guest is John Sandy, economics professor at the University of San Diego, right here in beautiful San Diego. Not to be confused with University of California at San Diego or San Diego State University. It's always fun for people out of California to figure out which of the three major San Diego universities we're talking about. But this is a beautiful private college. And John, we were talking about the banks giving out loans to people who didn't qualify, and you mentioned some of the bank standards. Now, what's an example of some people who have not qualified and why the banks, or maybe more correctly put, the government interfering with the banks was so eager to give out loans to people who did not qualify?
Well, I don't have a specific example for you. What gets it started is the idea that as long as housing prices are rising, these loans will be safe. You can run some easy numbers if you want. Suppose somebody buys a house that's $400,000 and they put no money down on it, but the market's hot and it goes up, say, 25%. So now it's got a market value of $500,000 and they have never made a payment. So over the course of time, the bank forecloses, which is something they actually are loath to do. They really just want to make their money on the interest payments. That's really what they're designed to do. It's like they borrow money at a certain rate, they lend it out, get it back at interest. This is how they live. That's the margin they live on. But if they have to foreclose on them, they would come back and they'd say, well, we had a $400,000 loan against this house. The house is now worth $500,000. They would sell it. It won't go quite this cleanly, but they would capture back their $400,000 plus $100,000.
So they were going to make money even if they had to foreclose, and that was the big elephant in the room.
The assumption that the housing market would continue to go up made the loans safe, you know, because they're secured by the real estate. So they made the loans safe even if the people weren't going to make any payments.
So is this the bubble people keep talking about? It's always going to go up. It's never going
to
pop.
Yeah, that's once you're to the assumption that it's always going to go up and never going to go down, something's about to happen. Something bad is about to go on.
Now, what made the values go down? You said it had to do with them packaging the loans to stockholders and speculators.
Well, there was kind of a secondary thing going on. Was that this is such a different world. Once upon a time, if a bank made a loan, they would actually hold it for the term of the loan. So a 30-year loan would be an asset they would hang on to for 30 years.
But now they're selling it off to others.
It's gotten to the point, I think at the peak of the market, and I can't quote you chapter and verse, but at the peak of the market, it got to be the typical borrower, person going into the house, would take a 30-year loan, but only be in the house for, say, 3 or 4 years. And the typical lender who would issue, you know, the loan for a 30-year loan would only keep the loan for about 45 days. So
45 days.
These things get kicked off to secondary markets. People buy them, you know, and renegotiate them and such. And one of the dangers of that is the person that's initially making the loan isn't going to get caught holding it. So, I mean, that's going to the next guy or whoever buys it or the next guy after that.
Okay, now this next guy is buying it for what reason? What's the value for him? Because he thinks it's going to go up, so he's making an investment.
Well, just imagine here. So I have this paper, right? So imagine this is a piece of paper, and it guarantees you for the next 30 years that a payment of $2,500 a month will be made. And you think about all the things you could do with your money, and you think to yourself, well, for the price of that piece of paper, that's a perfectly fine, you know, return for me. So you buy it. If that person that's on the other end of that, eventually there's somebody at the other end of this deal that has to pay the $2,500 a month. If that person stops paying the $2,500 a month, then your piece of paper isn't worth anything anymore. Well, it's worth its piece of paperness, and that's it. So you had that going on, but what made it much uglier is that in addition to the kind of usual buying and selling of loans, which is pretty easy to understand, people begin to bundle them and say things like, well, I have here, you know, 50 loans, and I will sell them to you as a single asset. And they amount to, you know, tens of thousands of dollars a month, as though it was an annuity to you, like tens of thousands of dollars a month reliably coming to you. And if for whatever reason the people don't pay it, don't worry about it, because you can find the piece of paper that's attached to a specific property and go back and sell that at a higher value than its loan, capture back your loan value plus, you know, whatever it made on top of that, plus equity. And these things skyrocketed in value. And this is a dubious investment. People, you know, get leery about stocks and corporations, but a stock in a corporation is pretty much related to its profitability. These things were all being bought and sold on an assumption that these prices would continue to go up. So that's what brought the financial markets in. That's why when it all fell apart, it wasn't really conventional mortgage lending that got hurt the worst. Some of your bigger lending institutions like Wells Fargo were perfectly fine. They had not played the game. They had not made bad loans. They were solid. But it was the banks that had investment bank divisions and investment banks themselves, which are largely, you know, stock brokerage firms, people that will help you to buy into equities or bonds and such. They're the ones that got hit.
Okay, so it sounds like this was a combination of greed from the banks on one hand to sell these loans to others, but then where did the pressure come in? For example, why was a program like Wells Fargo not pressured by the government to give out subprime loans?
I'd love to answer that question. Or it could just be
it's interesting that some did and some didn't.
It could just be they held the line, and I'm singling them out, but there were other banks that, that survived just fine. Like I said, there's a couple of industries that are very easy to understand. Insurance is an easy one to understand if you think about it long enough, and banking is just straightforward. They are basically renting you money, and you're going to pay them back for it, you know, plus something. And they live on the plus something. And mortgages are historically the most safe loan you can make because people are loath to not pay their mortgage. They don't want to be thrown out of their house. They don't want to go through the foreclosure. And they prop up the mortgage market. It's been a very slow, very conservative, very safe lending market. But they brought in this kind of new sexy aspect of, you know, mortgage-backed securities and tied them into investment banks, which was unusual. I mean, usually these operate as sort of separate markets. And it got a little bit jumbled up, and it got way too hot. And part of the reason it continues at that point is that everyone's making money at it, right? And so you say, well, this is where we're going to go. This is what we're going to do. Banks can lend in those places where they'll get the highest return. And if all of a sudden, you know, crazy, weird mortgages are the highest return because you don't actually have to hold them and you can flip them or repackage them and sell them this way and that, that's where the money goes. And that's what happened. And
so would you say the value started going down in the houses because sooner or later it was bound to happen, or did something else cause it to go down?
Some good advice on housing as a personal investment is to not think of it as an investment. You want to think about a house as a place you live and that you're going to pay for 30 years. That changes everything.
Instead of a place where you'll just keep refinancing, paying off your credit cards.
I'll get in here. This will become my savings account. I'll get in here. This will become my investment. I'll get in here. This will become the one singular asset that I can, you know, claim for other things. I'll be here 1 year. I'll sell it for twice as much and I'll buy something better. There's a frenzy on both sides for both buying and selling and lending. I guess there's three sides there. When the prices are continually going up, everything becomes more urgent. If you're out of the housing market and you're thinking, this is going to outpace me, I'll never get in, go ahead, take a chance. Take a 100% loan. Take a 120% loan. I mean, take whatever you can get. Jump in. And with any luck, your house will appreciate. You can get above the value of that loan, sell that, go into a more conventional conforming loan on a move-up house or a bigger house the next time around. It's very appealing.
It is. In fact, for me personally, it was one of the few investments I was able to afford to make, was to get into a fixer-upper house and then pay off some debt, and it did go up in value. And so, I guess I kind of lucked out before this whole thing started collapsing.
Yeah, I'm reluctant to refer to the housing market as a greed market because it serves a very fundamental purpose of shelter. It's an important market.
And I suspect it is the security for many Americans.
It's the security for many. And to bring us back to the macroeconomy at large, it's largely the market you watch to see both a turn down and a turn up in the economy. A lot of recent recessions have come from the housing market popping, and a lot of them have recovered from the housing market picking back up. So if you're going to look for one thing to sort of trigger a growth in the economy right now, it would be to see the housing market begin to pick back up.
Okay, we'll continue with my guest, John Sandy, economics professor at the University of San Diego. I know you used to think economics was boring, but I'll bet you don't feel that way anymore, McFly. We'll be right back. This is Bob Siegel. They say a man's home is his castle. So when it comes to the wiring of your house, you don't want to mess around with some unknown electrician. Instead, do what I did. Call W&S Electric Incorporated. W&S specializes in both contracting and repair. From troubleshooting to remodeling to circuit breakers and fuses, W&S takes a skilled but personal interest in your home at affordable rates. I know the owner, Wayne Klingenhofer, personally, and I can testify firsthand to his integrity. Call 619-447-8785. That's 447-8785 for W&S Electric Incorporated, license number 480539, W&S Electric. Welcome back to the Bob Siegel Show. I'm joined with John Sandy, a good friend and professor at the University of San Diego. John, two of the names we heard thrown about a lot right before the election were Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. I know they're government institutions. They were also banks. I know they were partly responsible for this. What was the scoop on them?
I won't be able to give you an accurate entire history on them, but they've been around for a long time, and they
since Roosevelt, haven't they?
Originally were entirely government organizations. I think it was Lyndon Johnson that actually allowed them to privatize, and they became sort of the group that called the tune on what rates would be, 30-year mortgage rates, specifically the conventional conforming loan, and they became the insurer or backer of mortgages.
So they were affecting other banks as well.
Right, so pretty much any loan has to have the approval of Freddie Mae and Fannie Mac to be considered a safe loan.
Okay, so then that would have affected even people like Wells Fargo and some of the others to some extent, wouldn't it?
It has to affect them in that they have to abide by either rules or conventions that are consistent with the operation of Freddie Mae and Fannie Mae.
Okay, so we have people people who the liberals, I guess, would be really excited about giving a loan to because they'd say this is fairness. People are getting their share.
It's not even...
Go ahead.
Please, Nancy from Carlsbad.
Okay, Nancy from Carlsbad. Welcome to the Bob Siegel Show.
Hi, can you hear me okay?
We can.
Okay, good. There's kind of a lot of background noise. Well, I wanted to ask your guest, Bob. I know you haven't really gotten to this subject yet, but there have been a lot of predictions. I've been hearing that we should kind of dissolve all of our stocks and mutual funds and get them in a money market account because things are going to get pretty bad. And I just wondered what you have to say about that.
If I could tell you exactly what was going to happen in the stock market, I wouldn't even have to be here today.
You'd be Carnac the Magnificent.
I'd be a great deal richer. There's always two or three views. You know, some people are going to want to get out. A money market fund, the idea is to have something that pays with safety, right? You'll know exactly what it's going to earn, whereas the return right now on equities is going to be a great deal more variable. If you're kind of a buy and hold type person, then this is actually a good time to be getting in. It would sort of effectively cost average with less expensive stocks, the things you were paying a great deal more for a few years ago, and if they should revalue over the next few years, then you'll make some money on that. A decision that's personal comes down to how you think the future is going to go, how much risk you're willing to take. There are always safer things to invest in than stock, and if you're very afraid of stock, then it would probably be wise for you to move things away from stock towards annuities or money market or even bonds.
Right. Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you for calling in, Nancy. So would your advice about the stock market have been different a couple of years ago than it is right now because of the trends and things?
A couple of years ago, meaning when it was very, very high?
Yeah, when a lot of people wanted to play the stock market to some extent.
You get the same kind of rhythm, as it were, to the stock market that you get the housing market. If it starts to roll and just consistently go up, then people will come in, and that feeds on itself. Suddenly there's more money, and that props it up even more. And it can all turn on when somebody says, well, I've had enough and I'm going to sell. it's all buy, it goes up and up and up and everyone makes money. But eventually you need to take that money out. Speaking of the future, as Nancy had mentioned, one of the things to think about with stocks is everyone knows, this is a rather large macro issue with the stock market, everyone knows you're going to have sort of a massive retirement beginning. Our generation, the baby boomers, peaking, I think, around 2030. I got to figure virtually all of the baby boomers have money in the stock market in the form of pensions or 401ks. And they're going to want to move that out of the stock market as they come close to retirement and put it into things that are safer or pay a more guaranteed amount, an annuity of some sort. If they were all to pull it out at one time, it would devastate the market. And so there's going to be some questions. Do you try to beat them? Do you try to beat the baby boomers out? I can't tell you when they're all going to go. I'm in a situation, a buy and hold situation through my pension at work. So I'm hoping that it goes up forever, just like everybody else does, and that I can eventually retire on it.
Now, so then George Bush, Bill Clinton, a lot of presidents have been responsible for some of what's going on. I understood, though, that Bush at one point came to Congress and was telling them that they should start limiting the subprime. Talk about that a little bit. Did he have a change of heart, or was he admitting that he himself had made a mistake? How did that work?
I wouldn't know exactly why. As early as 1999, so even before George Bush had been elected, the Wall Street Journal had run some articles on this subprime lending frenzy as being, unsustainable is the word we like to use these days, so as being trouble in the future. This is something that's going to come back and bite us, and we should probably discourage subprime lending. Bush had gotten in on that a little before the crash and tried to withdraw. It could be that he had good information, could see where it was going. Could be that he had a change of heart. I'm not going to fault anyone for saying, you know, let's try to encourage people to own homes. It really does help stabilize economies, and it really does help socially stabilize things. It gives people a pride of ownership in their neighborhoods and gives them more responsibility with regards to where they live. And those are all good things. So those are all fine social goals. And to the extent that, you know, lending is favorable and housing prices are good, you can achieve that.
Looking back, would it have been good for people to pay more attention to Bush and the Wall Street Journal, though?
Yeah, sure. You know, always looking back. Looking back, it would have been a really good idea not to have so vigorously lent money to people who weren't qualified. And I had a friend that joked about it, and I always find it humorous. It's so simply just says, who would have thought that lending money to people who weren't going to pay you back would cause so much trouble?
And it seems to see the irony with that.
Yeah, it seems amazingly simple, but it had the usual rules of thumb applied, like we're not going to lend you more than a third of your take-home income, or the maximum price you'll be able to afford is 3 times your gross income. It would have, on the downside it was, it would have cooled the market. So a lot of people that enjoyed great benefit of increasing equity would not have enjoyed that, but it would have been a great deal more stable. It wouldn't have risen as fast. It wouldn't have fallen as hard, and it would have largely avoided the situation we're in now. So the nice traditional conservative banking rules would have kept us out of this.
Hey, let's get a little bit political, because this became a political football. It seems like the Democrats have grabbed this by the horns, and they've managed to blame the whole thing on the Republicans, who weren't too popular at the time anyway, so it was an easy thing for them to do. How much do the Democrats really want to fix this problem? How much do they want to exploit it and make it worse?
Well, I'm sure anybody would want to fix it. There's a bad assumption that goes on in discussions of economics and politics, and that is that somehow the politicians are ahead of the game, or sit above it, or have some sort of a switch they can throw to change things. And it simply isn't that way. The politicians are very much the servant of the economy, and not the other way around. It would obviously be better for any party in power to maintain, you know, a nice, steady, growing economy with stable prices and opportunities abounding. That doesn't always happen, and they like to pretend that they could step up and change it. And it works very well if you're in a situation like this last election, where the party in power had served a full 2 terms, coming up on the end of 8 years. People were already a little tired anyway, and then you got a guy brand new saying, you know, not only that, but I'll give you 4 million new jobs, or whatever the number was at the time. They backed away from that and made it a more mythical, we'll save 3 million jobs, or we've saved 100,000 jobs.
Yeah, and how do you measure a job that's been saved?
You just
look at someone that's still working. How do we know they saved
it? Yes, we saved your job. No, there isn't any way to measure it, so it moves it away from the objective and makes it entirely, you know, a pitch or a sale. And no, the Democrats did a very fine job claiming this issue and buying it and packaging it. And the fact of the matter is the typical recession, I should remind you this, the typical recession only lasts 18 months to 24 months. And so this one was called as of December 2007, starting around December 2007. So we're coming up on the year and a half. So you should, even if the government did nothing, which is really what they should have done, just stay out of it. I would say they should have propped up banks, because you do need to have a certain amount of confidence in your lending institutions to keep the lending going. That was one of the big mistakes in the Great Depression, is they let the Federal Reserve, which is not really the government, but the Federal Reserve allowed the banks to fail, and it resulted in a horrible fall in confidence in lending.
So is that why Bush was so eager to bail out the banks?
Yeah.
Do you think they had the right idea, and that maybe we've just gone too much farther with it than we should have? Was the original, my understanding was the original idea was they were going to just buy some of these bad loans from the banks.
Right. And that was
not try to control the banks, not try to take over the banks.
The initial response was based in part on savings and loan bailouts that occurred, where the federal government created something called the Resolution Trust Corporation. People were able to, savings loans were able to appeal to the Resolution Trust Corporation to have certain bad assets taken off of their books. It actually worked very well. So I think the original model was to do something like that, take bad assets away from banks that had excessively
large. Okay, so it was a good idea that somehow went awry. We'll talk about how it went awry when we return. You're listening to The Bob Siegel Show.
How many times have you heard the phrase, they're all the same, applied to local contractors? It is unfortunate that a few can tarnish the reputations of many, but it sure is nice when you find a contractor with godly principles. But what if they only do floors or only the painting? What if you want to build a whole new home? Or you want someone to fully complete your remodel or tenant improvements? You need ProBuilt. Serving San Diego since 1987, residential and commercial, quality work, completed on time. Local Christian businessman and president of ProBuilt, Jim Bell, said, when people pay you to do a job, they simply want you to do the job. They expect quality work, and they expect it to be done on time. We do that at ProBuilt. For references and dozens of pictures of both residential and commercial work, visit our website, ProBuiltInc.com. That's ProBuiltInc.com. Or call our El Cajon office at 619-593-2965. We're fully bonded and insured. California State License Number 567925. ProBuilt.
I'd like to remind all of my listeners that the Bob Siegel Show has a sister program on our sister station, KPRZ 1210 on the dial. Every Sunday morning from 9 o'clock to 9:30, you can hear City Voice. On this provocative program, my good friend George Runyon interviews a different local Christian ministry every week. You can listen to the show while driving to church, and don't be surprised, you may find it so interesting that you'll stay in the parking lot continuing to listen and skipping those Sunday school donuts. That's City Voice with George Runyon, every Sunday morning from 9 o'clock to 9:30 on our sister station, KPRZ 1210. But right now, you're listening to KCBQ 1170. Welcome back to the Bob Siegel Show. I'm here with John Sandy, economics professor at USD. So, John, before the break, George Bush buys up some of these bad loans in the hopes that we won't have a bank collapse. You're saying that that might have been a good idea, but since then, it seems like it kind of opened up Pandora's box.
It started something brand new, to be sure. The basic backing up the banks is not a bad idea. They called it the TARP program, Toxic Asset Reduction Program, which is a nice acronym. Banks that were too heavily invested in these mortgage-backed securities were vulnerable, and the idea is, well, maybe it's worth it to prop them up with tax money, take those things away, and let them just sort of have a clean start, get back out there and lend money. Yeah, I think had it stayed just with that, that would have been fine. And had they been more effective in their elimination of these toxic assets, that would have been fine, too. There was a scandal right off the bat that, you know, some hundreds of millions of dollars had been spent on it, and it was not at all entirely clear where it went. We're having that now only on a more fiscal side, where this $787 billion stimulus package is out and about doing things, and no one's sure what it's out about doing, and there were no shovel-ready projects, and there are no jobs, and they were building, you know, towers for turtles or something.
Yeah, but it also seems that, I mean, I know Obama likes to give a speech and say he has no desire to take over the banks and no desire to take over the auto
industry. Or General Motors, yeah.
Meanwhile, he's doing it. Honestly, it's like if it was raining outside and Obama was on TV saying it wasn't raining, I think people would go with what they're hearing on TV. But aren't they now going into some of the banks and taking some control and even instructing them to continue with some of these subprime mortgages, which is just recreating the whole problem that started in the first place?
It would be hard for the politicians to give up the goal of allowing people to buy houses. And one of the real problems, and I don't like to say that's a bad goal. I think it's a very fine goal. But one of the problems of having the government take over lending is instead of having this very simple lending model that we've had for so many years where someone wants to buy a house, comes in with a certain amount of a down payment, proves their income, qualifies for the loan, is granted a loan, and goes about, you know, whittling it down over the course of 360 payments or 30 years, whichever comes first. The government might decide that there are certain groups that are more deserving of buying houses than others and make decisions on lending for entirely different reasons.
And those groups may not even be legal citizens who they're deciding.
Oh, there would be. It's hard to say who you want to help. I should be very, very opposed and very, very afraid of the government intervening in banking any more than it has to do, any more than maintaining public confidence in banking. I am quite confident in our banks, so I'm not having that problem. But I can see why you would step up and say, hey, we're going to back these. They aren't going to fall apart. Yeah. Your money's going to be safe. Your loans are going to, you're going to keep paying your loans. Life tomorrow will be like life today. That's very important.
Well, to the degree that the government interferes, I know people do have this concern that we mentioned at the top of the show about socialism. So give us your own take on socialism, capitalism, advantages, disadvantages. And I know that you and I as Christians know many people who, at least when the government's not involved, they like some of the socialistic things they see in the Book of Acts, like the church coming together and voluntarily redistributing their own wealth. But I guess the key operative word there would be voluntarily doing it.
Yeah, and I'm sure, like any other taxpaying citizen, you don't feel entirely bad that some of your money goes to people that are less fortunate than you that you don't know directly. It's not a bad thing to have a certain amount of redistribution.
As far as it goes,
it's not a bad thing. I think, you know, having a social net, saying as a society we don't want any individual to become entirely destitute, does not seem like a bad goal, and it's not horribly expensive, although there's certainly a lot of things you could do with the money. It's not the biggest waste government has ever been involved in, but it is, like most government things, a large waste. Just so we have a definition, socialism in economic terms simply means that the government takes over the means of production. And that could be, well, the GM thing is, there's no denying that one. No sense dodging that. That would be the means of producing cars. That would be a socialist institution now, government motors. Banks, you know, you really want to have those things running independently, much like the media would want running independently.
Now, the difference between socialism and communism would be one of degree, correct?
Well, as I understand it, socialism is sort of an operating term by which the government would own things and, you know, essentially be, well, just let's have it be that way. The government would own things. The finer, if not nuanced, distinction for communism would be a philosophical belief that the fundamental problems that are that we see in the world, the sort of human suffering that we see in the world, is primarily caused by the ownership of private property. So tie you back to this whole Christian religious tie into the economy. If you look at the great sages, and I don't want to say Marx was a great sage, but if you look at the great sages, you could start with the most familiar probably for you and I and your audience, which would be Jesus. And Jesus sort of looks out at the world, sees human suffering, and of course he has a bit of an edge on this and says the fundamental cause of human suffering is sin and provides a solution through his death and resurrection. Earlier than that, Buddha had looked out over the world and saw human suffering and concluded that the fundamental cause of human suffering was the self and advocated a system of selflessness. And I actually see Marx as something of a Buddha derivative, which is to say he sees suffering but doesn't see it as self per se, but sees it as self-ownership or private ownership, and then precludes private ownership. And then the examples of communism that we've had over the years, either China or, I guess, more recently Venezuela and or the Russian Empire, the Soviet Union, is how do you actually implement a system where there's no private ownership? And that I would be loath to even consider. Capitalism, I think, is misnamed. It goes back to the same debate as to who owns capital, who owns the means of production. So socialism would be the capital is owned by the government. And for those of you who are more formally educated, by government we mean the classic European sense of institutions of government or the state, as opposed to just the operation of governance, which can be largely individual or familial or family. Where was I going with that?
But so, now, there could be a country that has both degrees of socialism and still some things in the private sector, still some things in the government sector.
Everything gets mixed. In the United States, you've always had examples of socialism. There's going to be roads that
The welfare program.
Well, even beyond redistributive things, public education is...
The police department.
Public safety. But we'd all agree, like, there's certain things that...
That you have to.
Well, yeah, I think, by and large, national security, a justice system, public safety, these are largely and probably best entrusted to a third party. And it sounds mean, but a third party that can coerce money away from you. So it's the taxing power of the government that allows it to provide these goods and services. And those are important goods and services, and they definitely aid in the smooth functioning of a society. So I'm a big fan of national defense and a big fan of a good justice system and a big fan of public safety.
Okay. My special guest is John Sandy, economics professor at USD. We'll be back with one more segment on The Bob Siegel Show. Good projects don't just happen. Good projects are a result of a team of dedicated professionals, owners, architects, and contractors striving toward a common goal. Make OMP a part of your team. If you're looking for professional, knowledgeable experience for your construction project team, Oso Miller Pacific should be your first call. For over 20 years, Mark Miller has been providing project management and constructive services throughout San Diego and Southern California. As president of Oso Miller Pacific, Mark continues this tradition of providing the most professional services in the industry to the healthcare, commercial, and government construction markets. Oso Miller Pacific provides a full range of pre-construction services, including definition of needs, design team selection, concept budget generation, and construction services. This full range of services is what sets Oso Miller Pacific apart from its competition. Visit their website at osomillerpacific.com. That's www.osomillerpacific.com or call the offices at 619-449-0633. Again, the number is 619-449-0633. Good projects don't just happen. Call Oso Miller Pacific. This is Bob Siegel inviting you to tune in for the Rick Amato Show four nights a week here on 1170 KCBQ. Rick stays on top of the issues local and national. He also does some of the most stimulating interviews you've ever heard. That's the Rick Amato Show, Monday through Thursdays from 9 p.m. to 11 p.m. here on Intelligent Talk 1170 KCBQ. You can also find Rick on AmatoTalk.com. Welcome back to the Bob Siegel Show. John, we're down to our last segment, and because we'll probably be in the middle of something when we suddenly have to break, let me at this time thank you for coming on the show. You're a bright guy, and just as a friend, it's really good to see you and catch up.
It's been a pleasure.
Well, I'd like you to speculate a little bit, maybe not like those stock market speculators that got us into this mess, but the Obama administration, I don't know how he says it with a straight face. He says he has no desire for the government to take over things, and it seems like our government's bigger than it's ever been. As an economist, your appraisal, what do you think Obama's trying to do? Some people are of the belief that he's really hoping to just completely destroy the system and then out of the ashes turn us into straight socialism and then blame it all on George W. Bush back to that perfect storm.
Well, and that's a possibility. I think I've adopted a paradigm with regards to the government, and I should warn everybody in the audience that economics is best discussed devoid of politics, but inevitably they overlap. I have adopted the following analogy I shall share with you. That is, it's best to look at the government as a parasite, and it is essentially sucking life off of the private sector. Now, a good parasite knows not to kill the host, and about the only distinction I will draw between, and this is only on average, between Democrats and Republicans is that the Republicans are good parasites and that they would like to see the private sector grow so they can continue to suck life off the private sector. But the Democrats seem to have adopted this view that they can kill the host and still go on living.
And they're kind of deluding themselves.
That's a very bad parasite finds out the hard way that if you kill the host, there's nothing left for you. So as far as the policies go, they're very much in the Keynesian mold. There's nothing horribly novel except for the magnitude of the size. If you believe, and this is rather a broad strokes of the view of the Keynesian model of the economy, if you believe that it's just about spending, and the spending can be categorized, so there's consumer spending, which is by far and away the biggest thing in the United States, and then there's investment spending, and then there's government spending, and then there's net exports, the value of our exports minus the value of our imports, which has run negative for us for quite some time. And any positive increment in any of those categories positively increases the economy or causes the economy to grow. And it's easy to see that if the economy slides into a recession because you've got less private spending or you've got less consumption spending or less investment spending, that the government could, in theory, kick it up, spend more money, by definition, numerically, as it were, raise your GDP, and as the economy begins to grow again, back off, you know, lower its spending, allow the relative growth of the consumer and the investor again, and, this could be a way of doing it. So I would say their intent is probably just purely Keynesian, that the economy is slow and that they might be able to stimulate it. The problem with it is that when the government wades in, it has the potential, while it does have the potential to do some good, it has the potential to do a great deal of bad. And I think more often than not, and not even with bad intentions, it's going to do things that have unintended consequences. It's going to do things that are eventually detrimental to the growth in the private parts of the economy, and it's going to slow down job growth and opportunities that would occur otherwise. So honestly, it's something like how you would approach a large wildfire. You know, you can let it burn through and wait for things to regrow, which is a painful thing to watch and a painful thing to do. But it, in fact, the forest will grow back. Or you can get in there and fight it hard, and then it'll still burn down, and then you'll have fought real hard, and it'll burn down, and it'll regrow on its own. So they're taking the firefighter approach. They see the economy is in danger. They're in there throwing tons of money at it, and it's not doing anything, and it won't do anything. It's really, strictly speaking, very political. I think there's already been stories released, at least through Fox News, that counties that voted heavily for Obama are receiving more than twice the dollars on average.
Yes.
I had heard that many of the dealerships that Chrysler had closed the ones where people had contributed to John McCain as opposed to closing the ones that had contributed to Barack Obama. So there's no keeping politics out of it once the government's in. I mean, the government by definition is politics. So you bring it in, you get the politics.
Well, I remember listening to some talking heads during the election when we were just weeks within the election. We were at the very late in October. And Charles Krauthammer, he's on Fox News a lot, Pulitzer Prize winning author, they were all saying, boy, our economy is so bad, it's not going to matter who wins. McCain can win, Obama can win, but nobody's going to be able to spend anymore because we just don't have any more money. And Krauthammer said something interesting. He said, no, you don't understand. If the Democrats get into power, they will use this as an excuse to spend more. And their wish list and dream list of what they've wanted to do for the last 40 years, they'll use this as an excuse to do it with the economy as their reason being offered.
Well, yeah, I think we saw this happen actually when Bill Clinton was elected. He came in very aggressive with a very large spending agenda, you know, some would call socialist agenda. And he way oversold the health care reform, lost the Congress. Newt Gingrich came into power about that point, lost the Congress, and really got tamed by what were very decent Republicans at the time.
And then claimed credit for what the Republicans did.
All the good things that happened, he was able to claim credit for, which a president usually gets to do. George Bush came in. He had a Republican House and a Republican Senate and really failed to do things that would have been very good for us.
Like, he grew government a lot more than you'd expect a Republican to do.
Way too much. And now we're getting it quadrupled, as it were. Yeah, that part is inevitable. The government is growing. It's the biggest investment you can have. One of the things you got to watch for here, because it's not as innocent as the Keynesian model makes it sound. It isn't just a dollar for a dollar here. The opportunities and the resources and the jobs and all these sorts of things follow the money around. So just imagine a very simple world where there's only consumers and we only buy flat screen TVs. And if you were to ask your children, what do you want to do for your life? They would say, well, I want to work making flat screen TVs because that's all there is. If the government comes in and says, well, we don't just need flat screen TVs. We'll take some of your money away and we'll also make holes. We'll dig holes in the ground. Then there's a new place for resources to go. I mean, and somebody might say, you know, the government will be able to build holes better if I build shovels. And so instead of just making flat screen TVs for consumers, we're now making shovels for the government. And so new job opportunities are created, but it's not a net increase in jobs. You're just sort of redistributing jobs away from things consumers want towards things the government wants. So if I had one large fear about the Obama administration is by weighing in so large, and I get the argument from a Keynesian perspective, you want to show everybody you're serious. You want to show everybody you're going to turn the economy around. But by weighing in so large, you're basically pulling opportunities and pulling jobs and pulling intelligence that would otherwise go to important things that consumers want towards things that the government wants. And I don't like that path. You got to imagine yourself being on a path here. They're all paths to economic growth, but I like the path to economic growth that's dictated by the consumer. I like consumer sovereignty, which is something you get. You'd mentioned capitalism. The natural result, the formal word is price system. But the one thing you do get in competitive markets and price systems is it's the consumer at the end of the day that really calls the tune. Businesses basically looking for things that consumers want that can be profitably produced, leave the government out of it altogether. The consumer rules. You bring the government in heavy-handed and you kind of dethrone the consumer, which is a bothersome position for me.
And then, of course, with the government, you have bureaucracy. And then when they claim that they're going to create more holes and shovels, of course, that's got, if you throw $1 million at something, of course, you're going to create some jobs. How many jobs did you destroy in the meantime? Al John, it was a pleasure having you on the show. We'll definitely have you back again. And we will see you next week, everybody.
Thank you for listening to The Bob Siegel Show. The views and opinions are solely those of the host and guests and do not necessarily represent KCBQ or its sponsors. The Bob Siegel Show was brought to you in part by the Law Office of Thomas Pinkerton, helping infertile families have children. Tom Pinkerton would like to invite you to help Bob expand his radio program by donations or sponsorship. For more information about Bob's ministry, go to www.bobsiegel.net. Here, you can read Bob's articles and get information about Bob's books. That's Bob Siegel, SIEGEL.net.